Colorado. And a man named Max Peter from Canada talked at that international. And he talked about being in Canada with a lot of men that couldn't stay sober. And they all wanted Max to be their sponsor. And he didn't think he could sponsor everybody, but he thought that maybe they could meet at a time when no one else would come and they could go through the steps together as a group. And that idea caught on in Denver. And a lot of people were in workshops and a lot of people did workshops. And my sponsor was one of those men that did workshops in Denver. And they found people that couldn't stay sober staying sober because they were having an experience. And about 2 years ago, I moved here to Santa Monica, and a friend of mine that's here tonight, Al, asked me about this workshop idea. And 20 of us got together 2 years ago, I think last month. And we went through the steps together as a group. And I believe we started with about 24 and we ended with about 18. And as a result of that, when that finished, they decided they wanted to do a regular meeting. And they kind of were interested in 10, 11, and 12 because they had just gone through the first 9 steps. And this little group started down in the basement here with about 15 or 20 people. That group has doubled in size in a year, and it's become a very effective group. Several of the people that were in that workshop 2 years ago are here tonight. Since then, several workshops have sprung up from that. To my knowledge, there's about 20 workshops now in the Los Angeles area, including Orange County. There's people here tonight from Orange County. There's people here tonight from all over Los Angeles that are involved in the workshop process. I know that 6 years ago when I was in one and going through the process with the man that's going to speak tonight, it saved my life. And to even feel a part of what's going on, to think that that small workshop from 2 years ago has somehow in the AA way touched everyone in this room, either directly or indirectly, is I guess what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It's kind of overwhelming to me to be in a room in Southern California from only being here 2 years and knowing this many people, knowing most of you. I mean, that's just overwhelming to me. 6 years ago, nobody wanted me in their life. And several of you care about me today, and you care about each other, and we're here joining in a common solution that I don't find all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, with no further ado, I'd like to introduce our speaker from Denver, Colorado, Don P.
My name is Don, and I am an alcoholic. This is going to be interesting. My heart is so full, I don't know if I can even talk to you. In the last month and a half, I've had some things just fill me beyond belief. And 6 days from now, I celebrate an AA birthday. And I am among friends, and I know that. And you get to be the recipient of all this stuff. I haven't had a chance to talk about where I've been, what's been happening, and all this stuff gathering up. I just returned from a week meeting with people from 32 different countries in Alcoholics Anonymous, spending an entire week talking about how we can better carry the message. Then I got together with my sponsor and some old friends from the Denver Young People's Group down in Kentucky for the weekend. And then we spent 17 days in the Soviet Union talking about Alcoholics Anonymous to them. So it was like being in AA in 1935. I am an alcoholic. And I belong here. It's the first place that I ever belonged on this planet. When I got here, I felt different and strange. My sponsor says, well, that's because you're different and you're strange. But I've been feeling that way for a long time. And somewhere along the way, I discovered that alcohol changed that for a little bit. For a period of time, each day, it was okay to be me, and it was okay for you to be you. But it is in my nature that if one works, you take 10. If it's worth doing, it's worth abusing. And I don't know why, that's just me. I drank alcoholically from my very first drink. I don't have the vaguest idea what controlled drinking is. I never really tried it. I tried to get control of my feelings, my mind, and my life. But I don't understand controlled drinking. Who cares? I didn't like throwing up. But that's the price you pay for having fun. I've been doing a lot of thinking this week, as happens as you come up on your birthday week. You look back and you remember what it was like. Christmas week of 1967 was a bitch. I weighed 133 pounds. I lived in a real dingy basement apartment with my two little boys. We paid $45 a month rent, and the old lady who owned the place had cats, and her place was cleaner than mine was. I was on federal parole for a little indiscretion I'd committed in 1966. And I was in trouble. This time I was in the kind of trouble that ends with either death or sobriety. I was finally in the kind of trouble I couldn't explain away. I was beginning that week to finally become aware of the fact that all my dreams were dead. They were never, ever going to happen. The stuff I had in mind for me as I grew up wasn't going to happen. The stuff my people had in mind for me was never going to happen. I was finally finally forced into whatever frame of mind it is that tells you you're cooked. Powerless, unable to do anything about the circumstances of my life, and unable to quit. Unable to be honest enough to quit. I was also, at that time, putting an awful lot of amphetamines up my arm. I don't belong to any debating society. I'm an alcoholic, and I used a lot of dope. But if anyone wants to talk about that later, we'll talk about it. But I'm an alcoholic, and finally hit the bottom. Now, I've been living on the bottom for about 3.5 years. I had reached a place where I knew I could never be sane. You know, I had this obsession with being the best. Can't be the best, I don't want to play. My brother was playing music with Stan Kenton when he was 19. I picked up the trumpet and couldn't do that, so I quit. And it was that way with anything in my life. Christmas week in 1967, I got to look at Don for exactly who Don was. That hurt. I don't want to belabor the point, but I got to tell you a couple things that happened today, that week, because that's why I'm here today. I met the first requirement of recovery. The first requirement of stepping onto any spiritual path is the recognition of the fact that in and of myself, I can't do it. Not anymore. I'd looked at the things that were going on. I'd looked at our apartment. I'd looked at my parole. I'd looked at what we were eating. I couldn't get out of bed that week until my connection got there to give me a fix so I could get up and go out and steal whatever we needed to get on the rest of the day. And I had always prided myself that I'd never turned on young people. I'm one of the people that came out of Berkeley in the 60s, screaming out, "Where there's dope, there's hope, burn down City Hall." Throwing Owsley's acid all over the place and doing my best to destroy this planet and myself. And I didn't have the strength to do that anymore. But I had never turned on young people. I was proud of that. My connection was 16 years old. I had turned him on. I was using him for a runner. And I saw that finally. Our Christmas tree was an alcoholic marvel. We got it for a dollar Christmas Eve. We found the dollar in the snow. And the tree was the biggest one they had on the lot, and it didn't fit the room. It tilted at the top. Didn't I get you? Well, that got me. I had an image of me, and it began to crumble that way. That isn't how it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to get your Christmas tree with a dollar you find in the snow. The only two Christmas presents my children had were some stuff I'd gotten on credit, because we were on welfare and the check hadn't gotten there yet. So we had a pair of cowboy boots and a cowboy shirt wrapped up for my little boys. And the kids had taken everything in the house and wrapped it up in blue paper towel so I'd have a decent Christmas. And some more of me broke. Come in. Is that real? Okay. You heard it too? I'm all right. It hadn't always been that way. A lot of things had happened that week, but the killer came, thank God. On Christmas Day, when the boys and I went down to my folks' place so they could spend Christmas Day with Grandma and Grandpa, my dad met us at the door and he said, "I'm sorry, but your mother says I can't let you in anymore because she can't stand watching you die." And for the first time in my life, I saw what I'd been doing to my people. Finally saw it. And then Dad made a lie out of my last great big rationale. I used to scream out, "Nobody cares whether we live or die. We're not hurting anybody else because nobody else cares." And he snuck us in the house anyway because he loved us. And I saw that. And I saw what I've been doing to my children. I don't know why they kept giving them back to me, but they did. And we lived in crash pads. Our little boys were brought up thinking that hiding out in an attic with the Hell's Angels downstairs to protect you was a normal way of life. And for them it was, until some damn fool told my kids about school and they wanted to go. And the train hit me. I saw what I'd been doing to them. And I went home and did that thing that I believe all alcoholics must do eventually. I reached the place where I couldn't stand being me one more minute. It's over. I became willing to do anything anybody said and go anywhere anybody said. If it meant I didn't have to be me anymore, and there was nobody left to tell me where to go and what to do. So I met the first requirement of recovery. I quit. I took a 2-month supply of Dizoxin and put it up my arm, drank everything in the house, and I laid down and I died. And I know about disappointment. When I woke up in the morning, the police were at the door, and I knew I wasn't dead. Now that sounds painful, and it was, but it's a grand place to be if you happen to be alcoholic. Wonderful place. A complete failure at living and a complete failure at dying. You just automatically do what's next. And what's next was go to jail. Now, I had set myself up that week because I really was tired and I really needed a rest. And 6 months in the county jail for people in my conditions is a rest. Some people in this room aren't through yet. I know that, and you know that. So let me tell you how to get through county jail so you can get back to us. I lie to you for 10 minutes, you lie to me for 10 minutes, and we both go take a nap. That's it. That isn't why they were there. This time they had 9 charges, and the first one called for 3 years to life in the penitentiary. And the Denver DA promised me that if I beat him on that one, he'd bring the rest of them one at a time. But I was through. And I didn't care. I really didn't care. I talk about this because it's important for me to talk to you about the power of God, as I understand it. I want to talk about prisons. I don't want anybody here to think I'm a big-time gangster. I'm not. The big-time gangsters never get there. I've been in three of them. Well, they took me away. 5 months later, when trial date came, they called me in. I can still remember. They said, you are really sick. No big news there. We have made an arrangement with your parole officer, they said, and with the federal judge and with the state judge. If you'll plead guilty to a reduced charge, we'll send you down to Texas, to Fort Worth, where you can get fixed. And two things helped me make that decision. I was willing to go anywhere anybody said. And I had been clean for 5 months. And the alcoholic ego needs about 3.5 hours to go from death to pretty good operation. And I knew, if you put me in a hospital with doctors and books, I'll be on the street in 6 months. They do something. Doctors and books would tell me what was wrong with me, about how long it was going to take to fix that, and all the symptoms I would have to present to them on a certain timetable to convince them that I was getting better. And I've played that game since I was a little bitty kid. I know that one. Well, I took their deal. And they kept their bargain. I pled guilty to a reduced charge. They gave me 1.5 years in the penitentiary, suspended it, turned me over to the feds who'd already agreed to accept me. 5 days later, I was in the Colorado State Penitentiary. Because the federal man at the last minute said, there's no hope for this one anyway. Let's just get him off the street. And I think that was direct intervention of God in my life. Because I'd have gone to the federal hospital and I'd have been cured of what was wrong with me. I'd have been on the street in 6 months, and some hot day I'd have had a cold Coors. And to this day, I believe I'd be locked away in some nut ward somewhere. I don't think death is an option for me. I tried it, and it didn't work. What's left for me is madness. But I had surrendered. I'd said, I can't do this. Very crudely, but I'd said that with my heart. So I was sent to the place where I could hear the message that I needed to hear. And I'm one of those people that believes that if you're an alcoholic and this is your first meeting, this is where you are supposed to be to hear what you need to hear to get you back to another meeting tomorrow, where you can hear what we have to say until you can finally hear what we have to say. My third week in the fish tank in the Colorado State Penitentiary, the man said one afternoon, you guys will come down and you will listen. I didn't have a whole lot else to do. So I came down with the rest of the guys and I sat down and I listened. They had three guys in there with green shirts and numbers on their chest, and one of them got up and he said, my name's Doc. And I'm an alcoholic, and that means that I'm powerless over alcohol and drugs and guards and all of the other circumstances of my life. And my life has become unmanageable. And if any of you smart bastards think you can still manage your lives, look at the reward the state just gave you for the nifty job you've been doing. And I heard what Doc said. I heard him. That's a miracle that I heard. They also said some other nifty stuff, like, your very best thinking got you to the penitentiary. You're not doing so good, are you? Then they told us the most important thing I have ever heard, and if you're new here tonight, this is it. If you are alcoholic, you don't ever have to drink alcohol again, ever. You don't ever have to hurt like you've been hurting ever again. We don't promise you a pain-free life, but you don't ever have to drink alcohol. You know, I didn't know that. My experience was, yes, I do. Well, they offered us this little deal. On Saturday afternoon and Sunday, you get a movie and yard privileges. And that's about it for entertainment. If we would give up our yard and movie privileges and come to their 12-step study school every Saturday and every Sunday afternoon for 5 weeks, we could then become a member of the Alcoholics Anonymous group that met on Friday night. Well, my friend Jim and I decided we wanted to go. See, I was in a bind. I wasn't the least bit afraid of being in that prison. I know how to live in prison. It's even easier than county jail. But I knew that in about a year and a half to 3 years, somewhere in there, they were going to put me back on the streets. Well, I didn't have the slightest idea how to live out there. And I didn't want to do what I've been doing ever again. So Jim and I went to their little school. I got introduced to sponsorship. Kind. Gentle. Understanding. We sat down, and one of the three guys that was in that room said, "You new guys, for the next 5 weeks, you have nothing to say. If you knew anything at all, you wouldn't be here." Couldn't argue with that. And they began to do the thing that Alcoholics Anonymous does if you're really in Alcoholics Anonymous. They very specifically told us what was wrong with us, and very specifically told us what to do about that. They answered the big question for me. All of my life, I've been running around asking anybody who'd listen to tell me what's wrong with me. And I got confused because everybody I asked had an answer to that. In this book are some descriptions of alcoholics. And I love this book, by the way, for a couple of reasons. One of them is that almost everything of any value in this book came to us from non-alcoholics. The only thing we do well is carry the message. We don't know nothing. Okay? And one of these non-alcoholics was a medical doctor who described in detail why I went to the penitentiary when I was 19 years old. Terms I could understand. One of the symptoms of my alcoholism is that when I start drinking, I get lost and I can't find my way home. And there's a federal law against that when you're in the Navy. I was stationed down here at Long Beach, and they kept giving me these 24-hour liberties, expecting me to get back. And I wanted to get back. I really did. I loved the Navy. But I couldn't seem to get back on that. 15, 20 minutes late, an hour late. Captain's mast was just part of being there, I figured. One time it was 23 days. And when I got home, it wasn't there anymore. It was on its way to Korea. And at that time, that was a shooting offense. I was in real trouble. The only thing I think that kept me out of prison forever was the guy I ran with was smarter than any of us, and he got us a Pan Am Clipper to Japan, and we met the ship. That's what saved us some of the trouble. Dr. Silkworth and my sponsors described my condition that day, or that period of time, in a way I could understand it. I went to prison for alcoholism. I went on leave and I started drinking. And 22 days later, I was in Pershing Square, mooching drinks and quarters and food and doing whatever I had to do to stay out there until I found it. I hadn't found it yet. It was there. I knew it was there. On day 23, that madness was gone. And I turned myself in, like any other rational human being, and went back to face the consequences of my act. He describes that in here. He talks about men who had been working on a business deal for a period of time that would be settled favorably to them. But they took a drink a day or two before their appointment, and they missed their appointment. And there I am. I went to prison because I have an allergy. If I had an allergy to tomatoes and I ate tomatoes, I'd break out with an itch. My allergy is alcohol. If I put alcohol in my body, I break out with an itch. Or more alcohol. I have lost the power of choice. And it has nothing to do with whether I love my family. It has nothing to do with whether I love my work or even myself. It has to do with the fact that once I put alcohol in my body, for whatever the reason, I must have more alcohol. Until I don't have to have more alcohol. I don't know whether that's going to be 2 hours, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, or a lifetime. I just don't know. I can't predict it anymore. Being out of control means you can't predict your behavior. You can't predict what's going to come along. God, that was good news. They not only told me I was sick, they told me why I was sick, specifically. That is my reaction to alcohol, and you know what? That's not curable. There is nothing to this day that can change that. And I promise you something from today's viewpoint. If they come up with something that would allow me to drink, you can have my share. Well, that was good news. That told me what was wrong with me until they said, now, if you never take another drink, that'll never happen again. That only happens after the first drink. So if you don't take the first drink, you won't develop the craving and do the things you do after the first drink. So we're back to the question, what's wrong with me then? I've got a lifetime of that kind of experience. Why do I keep taking a drink? Well, I had an answer to that, too. I could say. We knew that. One of the reasons I was in that penitentiary is because I was certified by one government agency as a psychopath and another as a sociopath type 2. Yeah. And the reason I didn't go to the hospital, they told me, is because both of those are untreatable. One doesn't know the difference between right and wrong, so you can't help it. The other knows the difference and just doesn't give a damn. And I was both. And then I get mixed up with you guys and you tell me I have this third terminal, untreatable disease that'll drive me mad or kill me. Thanks. Real good news for a sick person. The problem, my real problem, centers in my mind. I can describe it to you in a couple ways and will. That's why I'm here. I suffer from alcoholic insanity. And that's characterized by a couple things. It'll be different next time. It was the chili. If I don't have a drink, I'm going to die. I've earned this one. The main reason I drank alcohol, well, of the several hundred, I drank to feel bigger. I drank to feel smaller. I drank to be noticed. I drank to be invisible. I drank to feel good. I drank to stop feeling bad. The horror of alcoholism is the fact that quite often I drank for no damn good reason at all. There's a piece missing. It's not there. My neighbor has it. I talk with my neighbors now. One of the benefits of sobriety is that I get to talk with my neighbors. They're not talking about me, they're talking with me. My neighbor owns a bar, the East Side Store in Aurora, Colorado. We were talking a few years ago, and this lovely man described a night that he had, a terrible night. It seems he got drunk, and he threw up and made a fool of himself. So he quit doing that. Makes me nervous. Our experience was identical. It was a night I drank too much alcohol and I puked. And there's a difference. And I made a fool of myself. And what I did with that was learn what didn't make me puke. And I got to enjoy being a damn fool. My neighbor remembers what happened to him and how it made him feel to this day strongly enough that he doesn't want to do that again. And that's what's missing in me. There are times I can't remember. The information doesn't show up. We inherited a black lab puppy a while back. Beautiful little puppy. Came into my house and wet on the floor. So I popped him with a paper and I threw it out. The next day he came in and he wet on the floor and I popped him and threw him out. After about 5 days of that, the puppy quit wetting on the floor. And I was sitting in my chair rocking and a thought occurred to me. That dog is smarter than I am. I'd come to your house, wet on the floor, and you'd hit me with something, and I'd go next door and wet on the floor. He's able to learn from his negative experience. And when it came to alcohol and eventually a number of other things, I couldn't. And I believe to this day, there have been and will be blank spots. When all of the information that I have concerning alcoholism, alcohol, Alcoholics Anonymous, steps, traditions, blah, 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 won't show up. Or if they do, they won't show up with the kind of intensity I'll need to stay sober. And I believe that. So I don't count on that. In my 6 years of sobriety, I had an experience that brought this home to me. I was now working in the reformatory. Now, I'm not the only one that done it. They put me to work behind the walls. And once a week, I'd come into town to meet with the chief of police and my bosses. And God, that was heady stuff. The Denver chief one time told me something that just tickled me to death. He said, "Don, you know I couldn't pick you out of a lineup today." I thought that was nice. I had enough sense not to mention to him that that's academic too, because I don't show up in lineups today. But I didn't. But during this lunch, one of the guys had found a new liqueur. Even pronounced it funny. It came in a tall, skinny glass, and it was green. And there wasn't enough in it to do anybody any good, but he was passing it around so everyone could taste it. Everything I know showed up. It was there. My defenses were there. I wasn't going to drink that. I knew I wasn't going to drink it, and I knew why I wasn't going to drink it. But as it came by me, I thought, I wonder what it smells like. And I got it to here and was sniffing it when it burst into my mind that the difference between life and death at that moment would be the twitch of a muscle. That's how serious this is as far as I'm concerned. And then God did his thing, and I knew that because I stepped out of my body and watched my hand move that thing on. You know I haven't sniffed anything green since. If it's green, it doesn't get near my mouth. But I believe that this disease is that serious. Left to my own devices, I'd have twitched. So what am I going to do? I'm really in a spot now. I know I can't run my life, and I don't believe in anything else. Well, I'm here today because I used my eyes and my ears instead of my mouth. There's only one thing I wanted when I got involved in AA, and whoever had offered it to me, that's where I'd be. You just happened to offer it to me. I wanted to be changed. That's the promise that shows up in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous first thing. In that non-alcoholic doctor's description of us, he also describes our recovery. And he says, without an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for recovery. Well, that's a promise to me. And my sponsors put it in simpler terms. Don, you get a new mind. God, isn't that nice? They said to me, because I was really worried in that second step about this business of sanity and insanity, I really thought I'd have to spend the rest of my life on a psychiatrist's couch trying to sort out what I had already failed in 34 years to sort out. They said, that isn't what we do here. Don't worry about it. What's wrong with me is alcoholic insanity. He said, the most important word for you to remember is the word restore. He said, God knows, Don, that you weren't always a raving maniac. And he will restore you to when you were sane. And you get to start all over. He He also said, "We will assume that you went mad about 3 seconds after birth." He gave me a key. We suggest that you forget everything you think you know about anything, particularly about spiritual. One of my sponsors said to me, "Don, I don't think the truth's going to work for you." He described my mind. I take the truth in and my ego catches it. It says, I can use that later. I can catch the edge with that. I've always needed to catch the edge. And the best way to catch the edge around straight people is with the truth. Or some moderate version of it. Forget everything you think you know about anything. Started. If I believed it, it was warped. And I really didn't have any trouble with that. I knew it was warped. Yeah. I found out something. Even if you had told me the truth, by the time I got around to using it, it wasn't the truth anymore. So I am totally powerless. I've got a body that goes mad with alcohol, and a mind that's mad enough to give it to it. I don't know why and I don't care. I just know that's the way it is. Now, I came here to be changed, so I looked around. I'm looking for change. And here's Bruce, who was in that penitentiary for the rest of his natural life because one morning he woke up feeling that nobody cared whether he lived or died. And the pain of that was so great he started to drink to kill the pain, which he'd always had before. Only this morning, 17 years of age, it didn't kill the pain, it got him involved in it. The pain got so bad, he got into a rage, and he went downtown, and he killed some people. But the man that was talking to me was not capable of killing anybody. And I knew that. And I asked him about that. He said, "That's right, I've been changed. God changed me." I didn't care who changed him. He was a walking demonstration that he had been changed. Roy Nichols was a stick-up man who was no longer capable of putting a gun in people's faces and taking their stuff from them. And I asked him about that. "He had been changed," he said. "God changed him." I don't care. I was getting interested. They had some things I wanted. In addition to that, I'm very practical. Bruce got in and out of his cell anytime he wanted to. Now, I knew that because when I didn't, he'd come by and visit with me. And I wondered what he had. And he came at me one day with a hook. "Forevermore, I'm hooked." He said to me, "Don, do you know that it's possible for me to think one thought at a time?" And he had me. "Whatever else is here, whatever the price is, I'll pay it. That's what I want, the ability to think one thought at a time." I'd become everybody I'd ever met, and they were all talking at once. It was noisy here. I wanted to know how to do that. Well, they said God did that for them, and that I would turn my will and my life over to the care of God. So I did. I went back to myself. And I took the third step, prayer, and said it, and had the worst experience of my entire life. If it goes boom and rocks this room, I can deal with it. If God talks out of the clouds, I can handle it. I said that prayer and absolutely nothing happened. I can't handle it. Somehow what I thought was going to happen was that the room would fill with light. My clothes would go from green to white. The cell door would spring open, and the captain would come down and say, "We don't need you here anymore, you can go home." Nothing happened. I didn't feel anything, the door didn't spring, the clothes stayed green, and I got terrified. And I'd learned by then, if your sponsor tells you to do something, and you do it, and you don't get the results you think you ought to, go bitch at him. I did. Because I was scared to death. And I told him that. "Why didn't I have this experience?" And he said, "Dummy, That's a step up. In the morning, I was 38,984. Now I'm dummy. I got an A. So, dummy, you ought to be grateful you didn't have a flash of light. They really killed you all your life. And we talked. I've had some buttes. Southern Comfort on a hot day in Arizona, that'll give you a spiritual awakening. I've had visions. Had the privilege of eating peyote with the Indians in Nevada one Easter ceremony time. And had a genuine vision. I saw a great bird flying with no head on it and understood that was me and my life flying high going down. That experience kept me all right for 4 months. So if some of you are considering other means, there's one that's good for 4 months of sobriety. But I need something that's going to last a lifetime. I can't stand the other way. Okay. Well, we talked a little that day. He said to me the most loving thing, and you've heard it in AA. If you're new, it should scare you. It goes like this. Let's talk about that. Let me translate in case you don't understand English. That means, Don, be quiet for a minute while I explain something to you. This guy with surgical precision in what would have been very, very cruel thing, cut to the heart of the matter for me, he said, let's talk about that. Don, we found out I had a reservation. God had this work for me to do. It was good news, only I didn't think it was good news because I knew what it was going to be. If I truly surrendered my life to the care of God, I'd end up at the Colfax and Broadway in Denver handing out Watchtower magazines, asking strangers on the street if they'd been saved. I just couldn't see me doing that. So he said to me, Don, do you suppose that the guy at Colfax and Broadway today had breakfast where he wanted to? And I said, yeah. He said, well, you didn't. He said, do you suppose that that man that's making a fool of himself down there today is wearing clothes he picked out? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you're not. Don, do you suppose when he's all through that he gets to go home? I didn't. With the greatest love I've ever been shown, this man brought me to a state of mind that hasn't changed. And it's simply this. This is my life. Anything at all that God may have in mind for me is better than anything at all that I may have in mind. And that's all there is to that. My life became none of my business. And I've got to stand here and tell you, that's not a bad way to live. Let me tell you a couple little things around that, if I may. When I ran my life, we went to prison. When I ran my life, we ended in gutters and crash pads. We were told by our loved ones that we couldn't come to their home. That's how I ran my life. I quit running my life several years ago. And I have been places I'll guarantee you I wouldn't have picked. Last year in January, if I'd have been running in my life, I'd have probably been in Phoenix. But I was in Winnipeg, Canada, doing some of God's work. I wouldn't have picked that. It was 18 below zero in the lobby of the hotel. And our hosts thought that the nicest thing they could do for us was to take us out on the street where it was 40 below and let us hang around with the people of Winnipeg. They were running the Olympic torch across Canada. I wouldn't have picked that. And we waited and we waited and we waited because they were late. Someone in Winnipeg had taken a bunch of candles and some these things and painted them red and put them over the candles and made little torches for people to hang on to. And somewhere down the line we were told there was a lady in a wheelchair with one and the torchbearer stopped and lit her candle. And it turned him on so much that he was lighting candles up and down the street. And I used to say, people don't care. They're no damn good. I got to see that. I wouldn't have picked it. Another place I don't think I would have picked was Moscow in November. The day before Thanksgiving in Moscow, just a little over 3 weeks ago, I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where they spoke only Russian. The group is now 1 year old. And Sasha began to talk. Sasha is 5 months sober. It was a second step meeting, and Sasha was talking about his alcoholism, and I could hear him. And then Sasha said this. He said, "I have no history of God in my life." He wasn't an atheist or agnostic. He'd never heard of it. "I have no history of God in my life. But I wanted to be sober, so I did what they said to do here. And I have found a spiritual power within myself. And I think maybe that's God." I'd have missed that if I ran my own life. When I ran my life, they took my children from me and put them in foster homes because I was an unfit father. Saturday night, my children, my stepchildren, and all of my grandchildren. I've done everything wrong in this program from the very beginning for the wrong reason. 2 hours later, when I'd finished my inventory, I brought him back to him to take the fifth step. And this fellow who'd spent all that time being kind and loving and gentle and understanding with me looked at that and said, "That's garbage. You wrote that to impress me. Get away." Well, that hurt. And I did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do. I found a guy that would listen to it. And I began to have a series of spiritual awakenings. Now, that's easy for me to define for you. A spiritual awakening is any time any alcoholic anywhere understands any part of the truth.
Ooh.
That's a spiritual awakening. What I had done was made a list of some of the really bizarre things I'd done. I didn't bother with the directions in this book. And I would tell this guy one of these things I'd done, and he would say, "It isn't that bad." And I began to awaken, because some of it was that bad. What I eventually awakened to in that little session with him is that I had once again picked somebody who would tell me what I wanted to hear so I wouldn't have to do anything about it. And I knew at that moment that if I didn't stop that immediately, that I would die a very ugly death. Now, I'm not afraid of death. I haven't been afraid of death for a long time. I'm not too keen about some of the ways there are of dying. But death is no big deal. I've died at least 3 times that I can remember. But to die an ugly death means that for some undetermined period of time just before that, I will have to live a very ugly life. And I'm not willing or able to even think about that. So I got real. I, in fact, started praying to a God that I had no conception of whatsoever. A God of whatever chains these guys help me with this thing. And then I got this book out and looked at the directions in there and made an interesting discovery or two. I thought I had to find out who I was. That isn't what it says here. It says the purpose of this inventory is to help me find and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from God. The only thing that's going to save my butt is contact with a power greater than myself. This helps me clear the stuff that's blocking me, it says. I was one of the originals in Dianetics when I was 19. Oh, I loved it. Get head trip for hours. They had a thing they had me do for my father because I was enraged about my father. They had me picture his face on a punching bag and then punch it so I could get rid of the anger. Yeah, you understand that. I love it. I found out in this book that resentment is not a mental or emotional problem. It's a spiritual disease. That's what it says in here. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. It kills more alcoholics than anything else because it does the one thing we can't afford to have done. it separates us. If I resent you, I am separated from you. I'm separated from you, I'm separated from God. I just know that to be true. Well, this is an easy process. It said what I should do is make a list of all the people and the institutions and the principles I was mad at. That was so easy, that's all I ever thought about. It said I was supposed to put down why I was mad at them. That was simple, that's all I ever thought about. I was supposed to put down what was being affected in my life. That was easy. My sex life was shot. Okay. My self-esteem was gone. Blah, 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 blah. Let me tell you about one of them very briefly, because it changed my life. In 1966, federal narcotics agents broke down my house. That's how they come. Front door, back door, side window, knocked me to the ground, handcuffed me, put their feet on my neck, talked ugly about me. My four-year-old son let out a beller, and this big cop swung around with his pistol and almost shot my boy. And I hated him. He was on the list. There were 22 reasons I was mad at him. He had made a criminal out of me. You're not a criminal until you get caught. He violated my civil liberties. He humiliated me in front of my children and almost killed my son. I hated him. And I got all that down there. And then I tried to take this attitude that you all talked about then. He, like myself, was perhaps spiritually sick. You damn right he was. And I hated him. And I was supposed to take an attitude like I would for any sick friend and grant him some sympathy and pity. At that time in my life, sick people did not get sympathy and pity. They frightened me. I needed a script for every event in life, and there's only one script for sick people. What can I do for you? And I could not do that. So I just kept hating him. Then, without any thought, which, by the way, is the best way to do this if you do, I just did what it said next. It said I was to set aside the wrongs others had done and resolutely look for my own mistakes. Where was I at fault? Where had I been selfish and self-seeking and dishonest? Where was I to blame? And I had another one of those light turning on in the head things. I had personally invited that man into my house. I'd been smuggling dope out of Mexico and not paying tax on it. That made me his job. I'd been hired by a guy I knew. If he got in trouble, he'd rat me off. Based on self, I needed money. I took the job anyway. What happened that day was that I awakened to the fact that my troubles are truly of my own making. I did that. Now, I'm very careful when I take people through this process that they understand, truly understand ahead of time, it says, find and be rid of. If I can't stop doing the things that I've been doing, then I can't get rid of this god-awful guilt that eats me alive. I couldn't live with the fact that I nearly killed my son. If it weren't that I already knew that somehow or another, I would be free of whatever it was that caused me to do that. My kids don't have to face federal narcotics agents anymore. There hasn't been one in my house for over 20 years. I don't even invite them for dinner. If you're tired of being arrested, quit going where there's cops. It's easy. A number of other things came out of that. I got over the rage from my dad in that inventory with a real simple thing. As I began going over that, what confused me was here was this truly nice man who every once in a while went nuts and did things to me that were just not good. You know what? It occurred to me one day that maybe, just maybe, somebody had done some terrible things to him somewhere along the way and he was just passing along. Maybe he was doing the best he could with what he had, and it wasn't enough. It was the best he could with what he had. He had never done anything that put me in a foster home while he went to prison. I got off of his back, and it then occurred to me that maybe if he was doing the best he could with what he had, Maybe I'd been doing the best I could with what I had, too. And it wasn't enough. And would never be enough. Thank God. I learned about fear. I thought that it lived here in my stomach because that's where I felt it. I discovered in the inventory, by putting a name on all these unnamed fears, that I have a high-grade manufacturing plant right up here in my head. I can take good stuff and make fear out of it. Oh, yeah. Good morning, Don. How are you? What he wants. He wasn't that friendly yesterday. This is payday. Fear inventory actually turned into kind of a laugh fest. I don't know why it is, but every time I make a spiritual discovery, it tickles me. I began to make a list of fear, like it said. I'm afraid of being alone. I'm afraid of being with people. I'm afraid of dogs, cats, snakes, beetles, spiders. I'm afraid of talking to people. I'm afraid you won't give me my turn to talk. Afraid of losing? Much more afraid of winning. Made a real discovery about that. If I did something right, I just knew it was dumb luck, and I also knew you'd expect me to repeat it tomorrow. And I'd learned real early that when you fail, people are lovely. They will help you up. The greatest harm I did to my loved one is that I kept getting up. I kept giving them new hope. It just kept hurting. I discovered, by writing down all these goofy fears, that I was afraid of everything. I was particularly afraid of my mind. I told my sponsor that one day. I said, I'm terrified of my mind. He said, you have good reason to be. And I began at that point to really discover God's mercy and God's love. We live on a planet that's filled with people who are terrified. And they have to learn to cope with fear. The word cope means to fight the good fight. He told me I could quit fighting. Once I understand that I ain't got it, there is a prayer in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous specifically designed to handle this problem. God, please remove this fear from me and direct my attention to what you would have me be. That's an interesting prayer because it doesn't say what you would have me do. It says what you would have me be. I am not what I do. I am not the car I drive. I am not the people I hang around with. I'm not the job or the house or the money in my pocket. All of those things can be taken from me, and when they are, I'm gone. That's not who I am. I'm not what I do. I'm one of God's kids, that's all. One of his little children. And I got to tell you, that sure solves the self-esteem problem. What are you going to give me, or what am I going to accomplish that beats that, anyway? I'm one of God's children, and he loves me good, bad, or indifferent. Doesn't matter. He loves me when I don't know who he is and when I do. He loves me when I'm up, and he loves me when I'm down. How do I know that? I've been living in that belief for a while now, and it just keeps being demonstrated over and over and over. I was a person whose father came to a jail with his shoes and a note that said, don't ever call us again. And look at this room full of people that love me. And some of you don't even know me. But you love me enough that you sit there quietly and listen to me babble. I needed desperately, at the end of that fifth, sixth, and seventh step, because I asked God, please, remove this stuff and don't let the stuff I haven't found yet get to me before I find it. Now I'm still finding it. Found some more last week. Shabby shit. I entered my evangelistic stage. It's a good thing I was locked up because when it came time to make amends, I'd have made a mess of it. My sponsor gave me the key to freedom at the 8th step. I sat in a prison cell following his directions, locked up for the night. He said, I want you to make a list of all the people you have harmed. He started with the list of people who hurt me the worst. He said, add anybody you can think of, because you met them, you messed with them. He said, Don, you are fairly clear. You know what you did to these people, but you're so insensitive you have no idea what it did to them. What he had me do was close my eyes and one at a time picture everyone. And see if I could get a feeling inside of me of willingness to look each one in the eye and say, I've been wrong. I've harmed you. Would you please tell me what I have to do so we can get the books to balance? That's the night I had the experience I waited for all my life. I was lifted and set free. If in any way I have harmed you, just tell me what I've done and we'll get the books to balance. I don't push peanuts down Pico Boulevard. I make direct restitution for the harm I've done. Now that cleared up some things. I had some problems. How do you go back to the mother who has said on Christmas Day you and your children can't come in here? You don't just say, Mom, I'm sorry. I wish I hadn't done that. After I was out for a while, she allowed me to come by. And because of this attitude of mine, I found a way to ask her that question. Not directly, but I found a way to ask her, what do I have to do? She said, honey, all I've ever wanted for you was that you be happy. So from that day until yesterday, I go by my mother's house regularly, happy. And it has worked. She told me once it was 6 years before she believed I was going to be okay. But I wasn't going by to prove anything. I just show up and give her what she wants. Now, you guys have created some genuine problems for me and my mother. Because of your trust, you have had me do some really important things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not important. But going to the Soviet Union is. Carrying the message where I've been asked to carry it is. I heard my mother talking to one of her friends one day. She thinks I'm the president of AA. She thinks I'm single-handedly running around the world dealing with the alcoholism problem. I thought, my God, I've got to straighten her out. But I don't do things anymore without praying about it if it will affect other people. And I prayed about that. And the answer I got was very simple. After all the years of pain and agony that I've given that lady, if she wants to think I'm Emperor of AA, she can think so. As long as you and I understand I'm just another drunk, we're all safe. So I haven't straightened her out yet. My father knows better. You'd love my dad. He's an unmeasured genius. We don't have a test for him yet. He got bored with Mensa. He lives in a 48-room house that's full of stuff. And I was talking with him one day, and you've made me a listener. When I went to him to make amends, he said, don't do that. All you can do by telling me all that stuff has hurt me all over again. We start from here. He was telling me one afternoon as he looked around all these outbuildings, he said, I've spent my whole life accumulating all this stuff. I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life giving it away. And I heard what my dad really said. He was talking about his mind. So I go by there often and listen. And he and I chat. I even understand him once in a while. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous and just following these directions, I've had about 18 years to repair the damage I did with my parents. A little over 2 months ago, I was able to take them to the Epcot Center in Florida. Probably for the last time we can go anywhere. They're getting pretty old. My dad's planning on returning when he's 80. Revitalized. We gave him one of those little motorized carts the first day. We took it away from him the second day. He kept running over me. My father gave me one, I'll give you, free and clear. He said the other, not too long ago, he said, Don, I've lived a lot of years, and I finally learned there's really only two things a person needs to live a good life. honor and wisdom. You must have enough honor to keep any promise you make, no matter what the personal consequences. And enough wisdom not to make too many promises like that. These deals frustrate me because I run out of time just about the time I'm ready to really say something important. But if you'll indulge me about 5 minutes, there are a few more things I'd like to share with you because I love you. When I was at the World Service meeting in October, where delegates from 27 countries came to talk about how can we better carry the message, as we began to talk about that, the Irish delegate got up and he said, "Before we do that, I think we need to get clear on one thing. What is the message we're carrying? Am I carrying the AA message? Because I think I have a responsibility, not just to the people in this room tonight, but to the people that will come through that door in 50 years when I'm dead and gone. That responsibility is very simple. They deserve the same chance I got. And the message I got, I'm not to change that." We left that World Service meeting. We're in 114 countries now. Although the lady in Russia told us it's 122. That's at least 114 different cultures, different ways of thinking, different life experiences. You'd think we'd have to modify this deal, wouldn't you? Sasha said, "I have no history of God, but I found within myself a power, a spiritual power." And that's exactly what happened to me. It appears to me maybe we don't have to modify or change this at all. At least that's my opinion, and that's how I live this. I believe in sponsorship, and I've served long enough in every dimension of Alcoholics Anonymous to truly believe that every problem we have in AA, whether it be my personal life or the fellowship itself, can, will be, and should be solved by personal sponsorship. One-on-one, face-to-face, one alcoholic carrying his message or her message to the next one. And since I'm such an idiot, I have a tendency to use this. The only place I know for sure that the Alcoholic Anonymous message appears is in this book. There are a lot of people talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and writing books about Alcoholics Anonymous that aren't even in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't care how you do it. I'm not a thumper. I just know that doing it this way, I celebrate 21 years of sobriety Monday. Doing it any other way that I've ever heard of, I'd be stark raving mad somewhere. I love sponsoring people. The great joy of my life is to watch the psychopath as he walks in my front door. Daring me to help him. That's who God sends me. And I only know one way to sponsor. We start at the beginning of this blue book, and we do every single thing it says as it says it together. And many of them stay sober. Many of them don't. But I have. I do whatever Alcoholics Anonymous asks of me. Partly because it scares me to death. When you ask me to do something, I know it's beyond me. So I have to go to my father and say, "Okay, see what you got us into? But if you'll stay with me, I'll try it." I get to go all over the place. Do all kinds of things. But it's Bobby that I love. Bobby just got out of treatment again. I've been working with Bobby for almost 3 years. Bobby cannot stay sober. And Bobby's going to die. And I know it. And as soon as I get home, Bobby and I are going to sit down on the couch. We're going to do everything it says in this book one more time. Bobby gets halfway through inventory and falls in love. I'm going to start putting saltpeter in the coffee. I have service sponsors. I have learned some things from people along the way that keep me going. I've learned to ask myself some very important questions along the way. My lessons for this year are real simple. There are three questions that are not part of my life, particularly in any kind of activity with people. First of all, what do I want out of this? What's my private agenda? I've got one, always. All I need to do is find it, and I can get it in harmony with yours, perhaps. But I better find it. Is it possible that I could be wrong? Oh, I hate that one. Yeah, always. Modifies my behavior a little bit. And how many lives will be saved this week by this activity? Is this even worth doing? That's a beauty. Prayer and meditation are a vital, vital part of my life. I believe that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me get sober, but it's in the 12th step that I stay sober. And I stay fit. I'm busy about doing God's work. And you don't just walk out on the street and do that. You got to get fit for that like you do any other job. And I stay fit through prayer and meditation. And I had to learn the difference. Prayer is when I talk to God. And I've had to learn not to talk so damn much. Okay? God, please fill me with your love and let it flow through me and into the lives of others. God, give me the strength to do the right thing. Guide my thinking today. Show me what I'm supposed to do in this situation. Those are simple prayers. Take this fear away from me, please. And direct my attention to what you would have me be. But the meditation was tough. I've done meditation in every way you can think of. And so when it came time for meditation, I had to find something real, real simple. And I found it in the last place I would ever look, in an old Baptist hymn. I come to the garden alone when the dew is still on the roses. And he walks with me. And he talks with me. And he tells me of his own. And the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known. So I've learned to go to the garden. And the garden is within me. And I used to carry my baggage into the garden. And I'd say, look at what they've done to me today. What am I going to do with this? And somewhere along the way, I learned to leave the baggage outside. I just go in and visit. And somehow when I left, I either had the strength to pick it up or the wisdom to just leave it there. And a while back on an airplane to Texas, somehow, I rarely ever have anybody sitting next to me in an airplane, and I fly about 80,000 miles a year. And so I've come to use that time. And I was going to the garden, and it was as if a voice said to me quietly, Don, become the garden. And it interested me because I already know I am. But I pursued that. And I'm having a good time moving the trees around and doing a little weeding here and there. Keeping the garden tidy. And that's how I see our service. I'm a steward of my life. I used to be a performer of my life. Now I'm a participant in it and a steward of it. And I'm a steward of the fellowship. And all I got to do is keep it tidy so the message is straight and clear. I had become everyone that I had ever met. We're all talking at once, and I thought I was going to have, as I told you, sort this out, to find out who I was. And you said to me, that isn't what we do here. We'll help you find out who you're not. And as you dispose of who you're not, whoever you are will show up. It's like the story of the man who had seen Michelangelo's statue of David for the first time, and he was awestruck with this thing. And he said to Michelangelo, how in the world did you do that? And Michelangelo said, well, I took this block of stone and I chipped away everything that didn't look like David, and that's what I got. And that's how I see Alcoholics Anonymous. With God as a sculptor, and these little meetings, and our big book, and our step workshops, and all these little things that we do, as the chisel. with me is a very willing block of stone. One day at a time, we're just chipping away whatever doesn't look like Don. And so far, this is what we've got. I love you all very much. Thank you so much for letting me come share with you.